Welcome to my first of hopefully many Jewish philosophy podcasts exploring Jewish thought. A quick note on the structure of these podcasts before we begin. My aim is to take a fundamental question in Jewish thought or practice and analyze the idea through the eyes of some of our most celebrated thinkers. Once we've established a basic understanding or appreciation for this idea or for this practice, I hope to have a guest speaker on with whom I can have a dialogue or else interview in order to expand upon our understanding of the topic, deepen our connection to it, and address any questions that perhaps we happen upon along the way. I wanted to start with the question of why we do mitzvot. Mitzvot take a tremendous amount of our time, both in their practice or else in our discussion of them or in our study of them. Yet, I feel that so many people I encounter don't really have a more intelligent way of expressing their value of the mitzvot beyond, well, you know, God told us to do these. Now, that's not incorrect. However, there is so much more to it. There's more to it than God said so. There's more to it than this is what my family does or my community does. There's more to it than this is what my parents told me to do. There's a lot more depth, and exploring what we hope to accomplish through the mitzvot serves as an exceptional vehicle for deepening our connection to these mitzvot, our connection to God, and our connection to Judaism on the whole. We're going to address this question through the thought of Maimonides, the Rambam, Nachmanides, the Ramban, the Maharal, as well as the Ramchal. But first, by way of introduction, I want to bring in the words of the Rambam that he mentions in conjunction with his explanation of the mitzvot, wherein he addresses the significance and the importance of aspiring to understand the mitzvot and what they mean and what they hope to accomplish. He gives a little bit of credence to what we do, what we're doing right now, and perhaps a bit of encouragement to constantly pursue furthering our appreciation for Torah, for mitzvot, and for our beliefs. He writes as follows, in a bit of a harsh tone, and I don't intend on mincing his words. I'll do my best to translate. Yesh bebnei adam, anashim shekashe beineihem matan tam lemitzvah min ha-mitzvot. There are those for whom it's difficult to provide reasons for the mitzvot. Not difficult physically, but rather they have difficulty with it. And it's more precious to them that they don't think or consider or try to contemplate the meaning of what we're doing at all. And make no mistake, what has brought them to this point, this is an illness within their spirituality or within their soul. This illness, I believe, and these are my own words and not the Rambam's, is a sense of thoughtless complacency. Simply being complacent by doing what you're told as opposed to exploring the meaning. Now, the Rambam goes on to speak about how he believes this comes from this idea that if you were to not understand the mitzvot, well, then that reinforces how godly they are, since a certain divine intelligence that would produce the mitzvot, that would be unintelligible to mankind, reinforces their significance. How great are they, so beyond our own perception that we cannot even understand what we're doing. But the moment you try to give human perceivable reasons to them, it diminishes them. It waters them down. And says the Rambam as follows, again, not mincing his words, V'ke'elu ele chulshei hadat, and those weak-minded individuals, ha'adam be'enehem yoter shalem me'osehu ki ha'adam hu asher yomar v'yaseh ma shemevil etachlit nesuyemet. He says, in their minds, human perfection is performance of instruction and nothing more. And therefore, the less they understand, yet the more they do, the better. The Rambam proceeds to explain how truthfully the opposite is the case. Human perfection has to do with knowledge and understanding, making our own intellect and our own understanding or perception as close as possible to that of the divine. And the more we explore that our intellect will allow us to, but the more we explore the reasons why we do what we do, the closer we are to perfection. With that being said, I'd like to get into the Rambam's perspective on why we do mitzvot. So the Rambam writes in Moreh Nevuchim, A Guide for the Perplexed, in the third section, in the 26th chapter, that essentially, each and every mitzvah can fit into a general category, and each category has some benefit that the mitzvot were intended to effect. However, the details of those mitzvot are arbitrary. There are categories of mitzvot. Each mitzvah, each category has a goal, some objective benefit that the category was aimed to effect. The mitzvah fits into that category, but the details themselves are arbitrary. Now, lest you think that perhaps the Rambam's perspective is, no, of course, every single detail is significant and meaningful and divinely intended. I mean, they are obviously divinely ordained and absolutely necessary, but lest you believe that the Rambam's true perspective is that everything has meaning, we simply cannot grasp that meaning. I'll read the following that he writes explicitly. Again, in conjunction, in reference to the details of the mitzvot, rather than the mitzvah themselves. The details of the mitzvot. He writes, those or whoever imagines that these details have reasons of any kind, rachok hu mehanachon, he is very distant, very far from correct, far from the truth. The Rambam brings as support to his words this idea in Bereshit Rabbah, the Midrash on Bereshit, wherein the Midrash asserts, Uma echpat l'kadosh baruch hu ben shochet min atzavar ben shochet min ha'oref. Does it truly make a difference to God whether or not we slaughter from the front of the neck or slaughter from the back of the neck, even though all of ritual slaughter today and 99% of divinely ordained ritual slaughter is from the front of the neck? We do find in rare instances from the back of the neck. Seemingly, they both have some sort of legitimacy. And so according to the Midrash, or the Midrash postulates the following question, does that really matter to God? And the Rambam takes this idea and runs with it and says, no, the details do not matter to God. The point is that we're performing them. We are supposed to influence the world and ourselves and society and our relationships with God through these mitzvot. And what's necessary is their accomplishment and their performance, but not the details. Now, the Rambam addresses ahead of time what you may perhaps argue. He says, and don't ask why, if we were commanded to do 8 sacrifices, well, if the details didn't matter, why were we not commanded to do 7 sacrifices? He says, that's an illogical question. It doesn't make sense to ask. First of all, we need to do the mitzvot. They must be performed. And if I would have told you to do 7 offerings, then you would have asked me, well, why not 6 and why not 8? And so I told you 8, and now you're asking me, well, why not 7 and why not 9? It's an illogical question. Whatever I tell you to do, you'd ask me, well, why not this? But it had to be something. If it wasn't something, it was nothing. And if it was nothing, then we wouldn't be accomplishing the goal. The goal is for them to be performed. The goal is to do mitzvot. Don't ask me what the significance of doing it in the following method is. It's just so that there is an objective, sustainable way of practicing this mitzvah that is uniform and unchanging throughout the generations. That's the goal. That's the idea. That is what's going to bring about whatever goal the mitzvah is intended to effect. Don't ask me about the details. If you're asking me why A and not B, it's an unfair question. Because if I would have said B, you would have asked me why not A. And that's not a fair question. The Rambam goes on to provide now what he believes are the purpose of the mitzvot. Right? Beyond just establishing his general perspective, we need to gain some sort of perception on, okay, well, why are we doing what we're doing? Granted, perhaps there are categories, perhaps the mitzvot fit in the category, but when I'm performing a mitzvah, what should I be thinking about? What should be my intention? What should I hope to affect through my actions, whether in society or to my friend or to myself. So the Rambam says there are basically two general overarching effects of mitzvot, either tikkun haguf or tikkun hanefesh, some sort of physical correction or physical repairment, or some sort of spiritual correction or spiritual repairment. In short, it would seem that there are objective, either physical or tangible benefits to performing mitzvot, and objective spiritual benefits to performing mitzvot. Now, those objectives can be broken down into many different categories, such as correcting perspectives, right? Not having improper perspectives on the world, refining our character, or else releasing burdens. Now, releasing burdens doesn't mean casting off a heavy weight from upon your shoulders, but rather solving some sort of issue, through society, some sort of difficulty that everyone would need to encounter that the mitzvot hope to avoid. There are also a few recurring themes in the mitzvot, such as recognizing God and serving only Him, which has a fairly obvious benefit, and additionally, abandoning a pursuit of pleasure. Abandoning a pursuit of pleasure is very significant, and the Rambam goes at length to describe why exactly he believes it's so important. He says you can really lose yourself in pursuit of pleasure. Pursuit of pleasure it's not going to bring you long-term happiness, and it's not going to bring you value or meaning. It's not going to bring you much, and yet it has the character to take over your life. It has the ability to warp all of your intentions, all your desires, and all your thoughts to it. It really can consume you, make your life about the pursuit of nothingness, things that are insignificant, unimportant, and not meaningful. And yet, it's so overwhelmingly tempting that we give up, we sacrifice long-term value and meaning for short-term pleasures. And the Torah needs to do a tremendous amount of addressing, regulating, limiting, and restricting our pursuit of pleasure to keep us focused on striving toward what really matters. But without further ado, let's get into the actual categories of the mitzvot. And I'll do my best to, well, first of all, offer my own two cents for what it's worth, but I'll save some of my personal thoughts on the Rambam's general approach toward the end, where we'll raise up a few questions that I think are fair to ask on his perspective. Category number one. Again, we have categories, and then we have what the category is aimed to accomplish. Category number one of the 14 categories are aimed to develop proper perspectives on the world. Now, what are the objectives of this category? Well, really, each individual mitzvah here has its own objective, has its own obvious benefit, says the Rambam. For example, taking God's name in vain, it has an obvious benefit. If you relate to God, if you relate to whom you're serving in a callous or casual manner, you diminish the awe and the reverence that you have for God, and that influences your relationship with Him. It creates an improper, inappropriate relationship to God because it's overly casual, and it impacts your keeping of His mitzvot and your guarding of His Torah when you relate to it too casually or else lightheaded with an overly casual diminishing approach, we'll call it. There's probably a better word for that, but the idea there is the more we revere God, then the more respect we will attribute to both God and His Torah and His mitzvot. And another mitzvah that we can put in this category is repentance. Repentance also has a very obvious benefit. It doesn't need that much elaboration. If you have a system, a religion that strives toward a perfect ideal and it's given to imperfect people, you need to have a system by which we can come back, by which we can apologize for what we've done and bring ourselves back and give ourselves a second chance. There aren't people who don't do things wrong. I mean, the Gemara mentions four of them, but there aren't people who don't do things wrong. And therefore, if you want a system that works for mankind, you must have a system of repentance in place. It's obvious. Now, the second category is distancing ourselves from all forms of avodah zarah, all forms of false worship. So that seems to be a logical category, but his purpose, his reason, I found to be fascinating. Now, if I were to have suggested the reason for not worshiping other gods, the most obvious idea that I could have thought of was the idea of rebellion or else or some sort of abandoning of God. Right? We're abandoning the God who gives us life every single day, who gives us everything we need, who has given us national salvation again and again and again, who took us out of Egypt, who brought us to Israel repeatedly, who has sustained us and kept us alive and sanctified us through his Torah. And to worship another God is completely inappropriate and rebellious and horrible, to abandon God for the face of a false God. Now that's what I would have said, but that's not what the Rambam says. The Rambam says that the reason this is so bad is, well, this is aiming to correct false perspectives. How does that make it sound? What's the problem with avodah zarah? You're wrong. You're incorrect. You think you're serving something of significance, but you are not. Now, okay, that sounds bad, but is it that? I mean, that's what's so bad about it? Just being wrong? Just being incorrect? You could be wrong about a lot of things, but perhaps this sort of mistake. First of all, this is very consistent with the Rambam's thought. When he introduces the idea of avodah zarah and tries to explain it, there's a certain refrain of the shoresh to'eh, mistake, mistake, mistake. People have made this mistake. We repeat to make this mistake. They are mistaken. They think this way, but they are mistaken. Again and again and again, he repeats this idea to drive home the message that what you're doing wrong here is you're incorrect. You're serving the wrong God. You are wrong. And perhaps that's so significant because, well, God is the source of truth. God is the embodiment of truth. He's everything that is true. And therefore, if you're wrong about God, you're wrong about everything. There's no more detrimental mistake you can make than in not serving the right God. Perhaps we could suggest that in the Rambam's approach, because he believes the value of distancing ourselves from avodah zarah, from false gods and false worship, is correcting simply mistaken perspectives on the world, which is very interesting. And he brings in a few ideas, a few mitzvot that fit in that category, such as witchcraft, which in the Rambam's general perspective on witchcraft and magic and demons probably deserve a podcast in and of themselves. Shaving the corners of your head was apparently a practice designated for avodah zarah, for false worship. And shatnez, which actually seems like almost an unintelligible commandment, but says the Rambam, no, there is a very established, pronounced purpose for such a mitzvah, and it is because the monks or else the spiritual leaders of false idols would wear shatnez on practice, and this is how we distance ourselves from them. Category number three are aimed to refine character. Now, he gives a reason as well for aiming to refine your character, and that's to facilitate your interpersonal relationships. So, if I may, I would like to suggest perhaps a nuanced perspective that can be learned out from the Rambam's perspective on, or his approach to mitzvot designed to refine your character, to make you a better person. Imagine if you locked yourself in a room and through sheer meditation, you refined your character so powerfully, where you just became a tremendously selfless, generous person, full of compassion and empathy. And for days upon days, you're simply refining yourself, stopping to care about selfishness and your own needs, focusing on other people. But all the while, you're locked in a room. I don't know that the Rambam would see your character refinement as a virtue. He gives a reason, an objective, a purpose for refining your character and the mitzvot that are aimed to advance yourself along this passion, along this process or path of righteousness. And that is facilitating interpersonal relationships. So if there is no beneficiary of your righteousness and of your kindness and of your refinement of character, I'm not sure it's of any value. I'm not sure we even see it as virtuous to be a good person when no one is the beneficiary of that goodness. And that's a much larger theme that we'll speak about in one of the up and coming weeks on the idea of why God created the world, in actually not through the Rambam's perspective, but we're going to put this idea on hold for now. Number four is encouraging kindness and generosity. And the idea here is to help the less fortunate. The world always has been and most likely always will be unevenly dispersed in its resources, both physical and biological, or else the opportunities that we receive and the potential that we have to succeed. They're not evenly dispersed, unfortunately. There are those who have higher capacities for intelligence. There are those who have opportunities that others would kill for. It's what always has been. It is what is now and will most likely always be. And so we need an absolutely mandatory system of regulation in order to help the downtrodden, help the less fortunate, raise them up when they cannot raise themselves up and they did not have the opportunities that we have, helping the less fortunate. Number five is preventing extortion or burdening of one another. The goal here is to stop people from harming each other. I don't know that that needs a tremendous amount of elaboration. You cannot live in a society where it is the prerogative of an individual to take another person's property or physical health into his own whim or will. You cannot do with other people or their possessions what you'd like. You can't have a functional society that way. And anything that we have preventing ourselves from destroying other people's property or else negatively affecting them in any way inhibits a livable and successful society. Number six is an interesting one because it's punishment for transgressions. And he says that the benefits for these punishments are clear and obvious, similar to the first one in a sense. However, I'm not sure that I see it as clearly and obviously as he may. I mean, I believe you could perhaps divide punishments and their values into two potential categories. It could be justice by punishing a criminal could be some sort of just execution, a carrying out of what he deserves. That's not necessarily the only way I can see punishment. I can also see punishment as primarily a preventative. And in fact, I have reason to believe that the Jewish perspective is that punishments were more so intended as preventatives than as punishments. I think there's some sort of inherent belief within our legal system that we are unfit to determine or to take someone else's life in our hands. And we do so when it's absolutely necessary, but we try to avoid it at all costs, believing that ultimately God has the only accurate perspective on who does and does not deserve the death penalty. Now you can ask, you should ask, well, doesn't that undermine many of the verses in the Torah that clearly provide the death penalty for certain transgressions? You know, that's a great question, and that should be a question that you ask on a specific and one of our most celebrated rabbinic characters. In the first chapter of Tractate Makot, the Gemara asserts that a court of law that would execute the death penalty more than once in 70 years was a bloodthirsty court of law. And I'm left wondering why exactly we're basing that on years. Should it not be based on the amount of capital crime, capital offenses? Why is it that we automatically assume that you'd be incorrect to carry out the death penalty? It may in fact be warranted, and unfortunately there may be times that warrant it more so than others, but it shouldn't be based on years that you gauge whether or not this Beit Din is a merciful one or a bloodthirsty one. It should be the amount of capital cases that come before you. Now, what's more shocking is Rabbi Akiva's response. Rabbi Akiva, one of our most celebrated rabbinic characters, says as follows. Well, you know what? If I was in charge of the court of law, I would never execute the death penalty. That is an appalling statement coming from Rabbi Akiva. First of all, then you'd be a terrible judge, because then you'd be warping the law, you'd be warping justice, you would have a jaded perspective on every case that came before you, you wouldn't see it honestly, and moreover, you'd simply be ignoring explicit verses in the Torah that are instructing you to carry out the death penalty. How do you legitimize it, and why is this a character that we so highly praise when he is proclaiming explicitly that he refuses to uphold explicit verses in the Torah? If someone were to do that today, that would be their last day as a respected rabbi in an Orthodox community. How does Rabbi Akiva do this? Well, maybe Rabbi Akiva understands these verses perhaps a bit better than we do. Now, the response to Rabbi Akiva, I believe it comes from Rabban Gamliel, is also perhaps equally interesting. What would you have expected Rabban Gamliel to say? Well, I would have expected Rabban Gamliel to say, well, then it's a good thing you'll never be a judge, or that you're not in charge, because then you would be ignoring the Torah and warping justice, and that's terrible. So it's a very good thing you're not in charge. But that's not what Rabban Gamliel says, actually. Rabban Gamliel says, well, then it's a good thing you're not in charge, because then you would allow for a lot more murders in Klal Yisrael, in the nation of Israel. What does that sound like? That sounds like, according to Rabban Gamliel, that Rabbi Akiva is not wrong. We should not be trying to carry out the death penalty. We shouldn't even be trying to listen to these verses, as far as a simple understanding of these verses would indicate. Rather, the only problem with Rabbi Akiva is that his method produces more murder. Essentially, the debate between them is as follows. Rabbi Akiva believes that he is unfit, or human beings by nature are unfit, to determine that someone is worthy of the death penalty, worthy of their life being ended. Rather, God will take care of it. He judges everyone appropriately, judges everyone properly, and will chalk it up to God at the end of the day, because I cannot bring myself to kill another human being unless I am absolutely 100% sure. So says Rabban Gamliel, I understand the ethics behind your approach. Taking someone's life into your own hands is obviously not a simple task, but understand that while this has some overt short-term ethical benefits, long term, what are you doing to society when criminals understand that there are no consequences for their actions? Says Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Akiva, I understand where you're coming from, but realize that long term, your system of law increases crime and increases murder. And if you value human life and that's what's stopping you from executing the death penalty, just know that you are compromising on human life. You are sacrificing human life for your perspective. So, similarly, Rav Moshe Feinstein, when he was asked by the governor of New York whether the Jews believed in the death penalty, Rav Moshe said something very interesting, actually. He said no. And, you know, if I were to have a conversation with him, I would say, well, you know, well, Rav Moshe, I feel like there are a few verses in the Torah that you may be forgetting about. Now, Rav Moshe, of course, was very well versed in the Torah. And what he meant was not, no, it doesn't exist in Judaism. Rather, we don't believe that people are necessarily, or we don't believe that we are fit to determine who deserves life and death. However, we do need the death penalty or other commandments in the Torah as effective preventative measures in our own practice. Because as Rabban Gamliel said, if you did not have any punishments, you're not valuing human life, you're diminishing human life. So that's just a little bit on punishment, where I thought it was interesting the Rambam treats the benefit of punishment as so obvious, but I'm torn as to whether or not to see punishment as justice, or whether to see punishment as preventative, where we don't actually believe that we're the right people to execute these punishments, but we appreciate that we need to, as a preventative mechanism. Moving on from punishments, regulating monetary transactions, and this is the benefit is just and fair dealings. To have a proper and just society, we need to regulate our monetary transactions between one another. Days of prohibition is category number 8, which can be divided into the Sabbath and the holidays, Shabbat and Yom Tov. Now, Shabbat is, the intention is rejuvenation. Rest and rejuvenation, perhaps physical, perhaps spiritual. Now, the holidays should really be broken down and assessed each holiday in and of themselves as they have their own unique purpose. But the general purpose is national unity and celebration. We come together, we unite as one, and celebrate the salvation that we have at the hands of God. Category number 9 is action-based service of God. This also has a pretty obvious benefit, constant service and acknowledgement of God. You shouldn't be able to go a day, much less a week, without habitually practicing things that are designed to get you thinking about God and your service of Him in a very real and physical way. So these daily or else weekly commandments have a purpose of connecting you to God and making your service of Him habitual and constant. Number 10 is different aspects of the Mikdash, the temple, and their functions. The goal here is interesting, and it's similar to the goal of category 11. The goal here is redirecting our urge to build temples to other deities. It is embedded within us to worship something and want to build glorious temples to it, to glorify the name, glorify the deity. It's an expression of our worship of it. It gives us some sort of physical target to direct our worship. We need this, so to speak, in the way that we worship. And the Mikdash was supposed to serve as that, except for God. Similarly, we have by korbanot, by offerings. They as well were intended to redirect this urge that we had to slaughter toward false idols. It's how we knew to worship. It is what we knew to do in order to connect ourselves to God. Now, the way that we redirect these urges, I mean, you could say it's as simple. You could suggest that it's as simple as just saying, well, I'm killing this animal, not, however, for, you know, the Baal or the Asherah or for, you know, insert your favorite Avodah Zarah here. But you could say that one of the profound aspects of korbanot in Jewish tradition is that we play down the significance of the performance while we increase the significance of the thought. Both in Isaiah and in Jeremiah and Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, the Jews are admonished for bringing sacrifices without the proper intention. We seem to think that sacrifices are this automatic, self-sufficient form of serving God. We do whatever we want. We kill an animal and we're okay. And Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu come to remind us that is very far from the truth. That's very far from the truth. It's all about the intention. The sacrifice is a physical representation, perhaps, of our intention, but the goal is our intention. So much so that there's a law, if you do everything properly, everything perfectly to the T, and you simply have, for a moment, an improper intention, an improper thought, you consider eating this korban in a time that is not allotted for its consumption, the entire thing is rendered invalid. Regardless of whether you actually do that, or if everything else went perfectly, you render it entirely invalid. Because the significance of the korban is much more about your intentions than your actions. Now, it may be difficult for us to relate to a religion or else a time in history where these things were so deeply embedded within society and how you worship God that we needed them as directions of our desire. We needed them in order to worship God properly. And He couldn't take these things away from us or wean us off of them. You know, it may be difficult to envision that, but I think it's very easy to reframe it in the context of something that we do understand better. For example, tefillah, prayer. I cannot imagine what religion would look like today without prayer. I can't imagine what my own relationship with God would look like without prayer. Prayer is such a fundamental basis for building a relationship to God, a thrice daily, deep, intimate interaction with God. I cannot imagine having to build that relationship without prayer. And if we would have had Har Sinai part 2, where Moshe comes down and says, here are the new laws of religion. By the way, prayer was ever only intended, you know, to help you out, to direct your desire to get close to God. But from now on, prayer is off limits. We don't do prayer anymore. I don't know what religion would look like or how I would go about building a relationship with God without a conversation. It doesn't make sense to me. My perception of religion doesn't complement that idea. So I can imagine that potentially, if that's what korbanot were to the Jewish people of the time, they just simply would not have been able to connect themselves to a religion without being given adequate or relatable methods to do so. Now, category number 12 was probably the biggest novelty for me. And that's the idea of Tuma and Tahara, ritual purity or impurity. Now, that's such a novelty to me because, well, first of all, I never really had much of a perception of its significance. But the Rambam explains it as follows. You know, ritual purity or impurity helps us to navigate or helps us to regulate our interaction with the sanctified in this world. It helps regulate our interaction with holiness, kedusha, in this world, where we can go, where we cannot go, what we can do, what we cannot do, what we can touch, what we cannot touch, what we can eat, what we cannot eat. Everything is dependent upon our ritual purity or ritual impurity. It regulates our behavior with the sanctified. Now, the sanctified is a tremendous novelty that we have things in this world, objects, foods, places that have some sort of divine spark that are not simply the natural phenomena we're experiencing, but rather holy, sanctified, elevated by God. That's a novelty. And the worst thing in the world that we can do is relate to these sanctified aspects of our life in an overly callous or casual manner. I reflect in my own experience on the first time that I prayed at the Kotel, the first time I went to the Western Wall. You know, what a powerful experience in prayer that was. And I went back 1 year later, and in anticipation, again, what a powerful experience of prayer that was. Well, I've been living in the old city of Jerusalem now for 6.5 years. It no longer provides the same degree of inspiration or significance. It's far more casual. And this regulation that we have, the regulation of our interaction with the sanctified, prevents that callous or overly casual relationship between us and what is most precious in the world. Categories 13 and 14 are very similar. Category 13 is restricting or regulating our eating, and 14 regulating our sexual behavior. And the ideas there are to restrict our pursuit of desire and pleasure. And we touched upon this earlier, the value of restricting the desire, restricting pleasure as a means of focusing our lives on what really matters, on things that are truly important, as opposed to being sucked into a pursuit of meaninglessness that's so overwhelmingly tempting that it erases everything else. With that, we've concluded the Rambam's 14 categories and their objectives and their benefits. And as a practical takeaway, if you hope to perhaps intend to affect these results in your own practice, it may provide a little bit more depth, a little bit more meaning to your daily behaviors. Now, I did my very best to represent the Rambam objectively and argue his opinion to the best of my ability. However, I do have some questions. I don't like to say that I disagree with the Rambam. I like to say that I agree with the people who disagree with him, because in all honesty, if I were to have this conversation with the Rambam, I would probably be crushed. So I'll agree with the people who disagree with him. His approach is not the most obvious or relatable in my eyes. However, I understand that some people might find it very comforting. You know, to those who believe that every detail is so significant, So this might be a tough pill to swallow. But for those who are frustrated by the details, who believe in the significance and the beauty of the mitzvot, but don't understand why this that beauty needs to be almost diminished or watered down by excessive detail, well, then the Rambam's perspective may be very relatable to you, in that you can appreciate that while every detail is mandated, they're essentially just there to make a uniform practice amongst the Jewish people of these commandments. But they are not intrinsically significant. They're relatively arbitrary. Now, I have a few questions on the Rambam. First of all is the idea of 14 categories, because 14 is a recurring number in the Rambam's writings. It's the amount of sections that he has in his codified law in the Mishneh Torah, the Yad HaChazakah. As well, it's the amount of rules that he has in determining what is a biblically significant commandment and what is not. There are 613 commandments. The Rambam counts each and every one of them. But how do you differentiate within the verses in the Torah what is a divinely instructed action, whether a positive or negative commandment, and what is just prose or else speaking to Moshe or speaking to the Jewish people? How do you determine what is and is not a mitzvah? The Rambam has rules. He has, in fact, 14 rules. So this is the third place that we're seeing the number 14 come up in the Rambam's writings. And it's very difficult to assume that 14 is a random number. In which case, for whatever reason he chooses 14, if he went into the process of categorization and attribution of objective and reasons to the mitzvot, if he went into that knowing that there were 14 ahead of time, that makes me question the honesty of how absolute these categories are and how absolute the objectives are. If you knew you wanted 14 ahead of time, then you were going to find 14. And perhaps there was supposed to be a 15th with a 15th reason. Or maybe there was supposed to be 13 with only 13 reasons. And if you force 14, that may diminish the absolute nature of the categories as well as their objectives. The Maharal, although I won't go into his questions at length because we'll be addressing his approach shortly in an up-and-coming podcast, he asks, it would seem from a few different psukim that details are significant and details are divinely intended. My own personal questions, one on the logic of the Rambam is, I understand it doesn't make sense to ask why 7 not 8, because you just would have said, okay, well, why 8 not 7? But if the goal is performance, it always makes sense to ask why not one time. If I only need to do them, I need to accomplish them, at some point, why not one time? That's, I think, where I struggle the most with his theory, is that it's hard to sell me on it doesn't make sense to ask why you do it 8 times, because no matter what number I told you, you would have asked. Granted, but if you told me one time, if you told me the goal is to do it, it just needs to be done. And how many times do I need to do it, or how many offerings do I need to bring? One, I would not have any questions. I would understand that one is the minimum method to accomplishing the mitzvah. But if I just need to accomplish it and you're telling me to do it 8 times, I'm going to wonder why it's not one. So that's one difficulty. And the second difficulty is just trying to read the Torah honestly. There is so much excessive detail in the Torah. The Torah, which is proclaimed to be exceptionally concise, so much so that we learn something from everything the Torah tells us. Now, the Rambam doesn't disagree. We do learn something. We learn how absolutely a mitzvah must be performed. But to read the Torah, every detail that it provides, every nuance in the performance of our mitzvot, and then to suggest that those nuances and those details are arbitrary, it's very hard for me to reconcile that perspective with an honest reading of the mitzvot. You read the Korban Pesach, as we did a few weeks ago, You read the laws, the excessive details of how, when, why, who, and you're left wondering how in the world can the Rambam maintain these details are so arbitrary when the Torah spends an excessive amount of time going into the nuances of how we perform everything. They seem to be significant. An honest reading of the Parsha makes them seem significant. It doesn't make sense to me to read the Torah and assume that the details that take up half of the explanation, if not more, of the actual laws have no intrinsic significance. With that, we've concluded the Rambam's perspective, and we'll go on shortly, Bezrat Hashem, to the Ramban.